I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, when knowledge is power, the powerful frequently take steps to make knowledge unattainable or even illegal, such as the case in the American South leading up to and during the Civil War. It was illegal to teach those who were enslaved how to read and write. In Dangerous Learning, the South's Long War on Black Literacy, Derek Black examines the deliberate suppression of Black literacy in the American South. The legacy of these anti-literacy laws persists today. Communities of color continue to face educational disparities rooted in this history of suppression. Modern debates over book bans and educational curricula echo past efforts to control access to knowledge. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Many of us are familiar with the fact that the American South during the time of slavery made it illegal to teach those who were enslaved how to read and write. But scratch the surface of that historic fact and you'll see that it was much more complicated than just that. The white establishment did see an educated enslaved population as a threat. But how they enforced this prohibition on Black literacy and its impact on the overall society before, during, and long after the Civil War is critical knowledge to understanding today's attacks on public education. In Dangerous Learning, the South's Long War on Black Literacy, Derek W. Black examines the deliberate suppression of Black literacy in the American South and how that legacy of the anti-literacy laws persists today. And Derek Black, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I do want to get into the history. I want to know more about Denmark Vesey and some of these other influential, inspiring individuals. But first, I want to try to see the connection. Where is the connective tissue? They say, well, that was then. This is now. Slavery is long gone. We don't do that anymore. How do we find traces of those criminalization of literacy in communities of color? And what's happening today?
Yeah, I mean, I think I certainly understand that there's nothing on the surface of what's happening today that looks anything like slavery, and I resist attempts that people suggest otherwise. But at the same time, what we have is this suspicion of Black literacy and Black education that is rooted particularly in the history of the South. And that suspicion didn't disappear after the Civil War. In fact, that suspicion then leads to an attack on public education when Reconstruction is over. It leads to an attack on the type of curriculum that's shared during Jim Crow to sort of rewrite the history and sanitize it. And then, you know, of course, we have these sort of states' rights arguments that filter through the desegregation era, right? Still fighting over what should the level of access to education for Black people be, you know, in 1964 as we're trying to desegregate our schools. And then there's this, you know, period, you know, the 80s and 90s, and we begin to disassociate ourselves mentally with that history to a certain extent, that we kind of just sort of hit this stasis in terms of Black education, not really moving forward, not moving backwards. But then around 2020, when we begin to revisit this history again in our schools and start to talk about how we might make our curriculum sort of more open, more inclusive, how we might begin to rethink some of the ways that we teach, which we really hadn't done before. We didn't do that during desegregation either, right? That we have this push, right, to open our schools up a little bit more to this history. All of a sudden, we see this, you know, this sort of retraction again, this sort of concern about why are our schools trying to sort of move us towards a different or more open society? And the response is, once again, you know, book banning, restrictions on access to book. And guess what? A lot of those books have to do with Black freedom and the history of slavery. And so I think from start to finish is what we see is this general uneasiness amongst society at large with Black freedom through education. And I think that's the simplest way to understand it.
Our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We want you in on this conversation. Call in with your questions and comments, your observations. How has this impacted you? What are your concerns about the long history of suppression of education in communities of color? And so, Derek, when you say, I know you're from North Carolina, and that you have this very much focused on, you know, the African-American enslaved population and the history there. But when you say black, I also, in my mind, I immediately amend black and brown efforts to suppress education, because in South Texas, we have that history as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, it's not an exclusive history when we begin to build out a spider web. But, you know, when I do some of my other work, I have another book called Schoolhouse Burning, when I sort of talk about it more through a broader lens of democracy rather than just the repression of black literacy. But you're exactly right, you know, that the equality movement for English language learners, for Latino students, you know, for women, for homeless students, all these things grow out of the black freedom struggle in education in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, interestingly enough, we see some pretty serious advances for Latino students during that same period. And unfortunately, we see retractions, right? That, you know, we had a period in which Congress actively supported bilingual education. And then we sort of moved to a period in which it refuses to fund it and states start to sort of ban it. And of course, in the Southwest, and you're probably more, you know, attuned to some of these details than I am. But I mean, you're exactly right that the war on what some call Mexican American studies, I don't, you know, that may vary from state to state how they term it. But, you know, we saw Arizona, right, for instance, trying to change, alter, and ban, you know, curriculum related to Latino students. You know, 7-8 years ago, and probably you guys were following it a little bit more there, but the rest of America doesn't even know that that happened, right? And so there actually was this sort of prelude in some respects to the anti-CRT movement, and it was an anti-Mexican-American studies movement.
So we have in Washington, D.C., the dismantling of the Department of Education on Sunday. Texas Governor Greg Abbott had a ceremony where he signed the law for school vouchers. Do you see this as the continuation, the legacy of the South's long history on black literacy?
I mean, they're not disconnected. I mean, what's the connection between vouchers and this history? And what I sort of articulate towards the end of the book is that what you have is this growing rage against the system, this sort of growing, sort of subtle, sometimes explicit, desire to disunite from the system, right? I mean, our public education system has been something, for all of its flaws, for all of its discrimination, it has been something around which all of America's people have rallied for 200 years. Right. It is another form of the union. It is maybe the biggest, most inclusive union that the United States has ever built. Right. But at this moment in time, right on the heels of trying to make our schools, you know, more inclusive, more representative in various ways, that's the very moment in time in which vouchers gain a foothold that had been denied to them for decades. Right, like the voucher movement isn't new. It actually goes back to Brown versus Board of Education, when white families wanted to exit the public school system and do it on the public dollar. The Supreme Court struck that down then because of the motivations. Now the motivations are not like explicitly couched in terms of avoiding integrated environments. In fact, you know, we don't even have that many thoroughly integrated schools in America anymore. But our schools still represent these values, these sort of ideas of equality and integration. And when they try to take a step forward on those values, I don't think it's ironic that this is a moment when there are a lot of people insisting, right, that there must be a right to leave those schools. And I call it, whether people mean it or not, whether they understand it or not, I term it as a coded call for disunion. Right. Mm-hmm. And that disunion is a dangerous thing. I mean, if you think of our public schools as being something around which we build a democracy, If we leave those institutions behind, it spells something, I think, quite troubling for our democracy.
We've got to take a break right here, but we're going to be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Dangerous Learning, the South's Long War on Black Literacy. We're joined by author Derek Black. And you're invited into the conversation, 833-877-8255. So what were the primary reasons that the leaders in the South during enslavement, why did they seek to suppress Black literacy?
Yeah, I mean, that's the most interesting part of this story, is that if you read the conventional narrative, you would assume that Black literacy was always criminalized in the South. That's what I thought, notwithstanding the fact that I'm a scholar of education history. But as I began to dig into it, what I learned was that there were schools operating out in the open in Charleston, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, Wilmington, North Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, et cetera, that educated not just free people of color, but enslaved children. And these weren't perceived as a problem. In fact, there were a lot of white resources going into these, right? There were missionary societies that were supporting them. Of course, there were Black self-help that was supporting them. But what really changed was were a couple of men who opened America's ideas to the power of literacy for Black people. So Denmark Vesey in Charleston, South Carolina, planned what would have been exponentially the largest slave revolt in the history of the United States. I have no doubt that had it went forward, he would have liberated the Charleston Peninsula and sailed with hundreds, if not thousands, formerly enslaved people to Haiti for freedom. That much seems pretty clear. It gets thwarted at the last minute with the story that sort of gets out. But as they were investigating, as the Charleston officials were investigating this, they began to see very clearly for the first time how powerful an educated Black man was, right? That he could read and interpret the Bible for himself. He could follow the debates in Congress. He could understand the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and leverage those ideas to his community's uplift. And that was really scary once they realized that. And so South Carolina begins to really crack down. The funny thing is the rest of the South goes, well, they sort of get over it. They go, well, maybe that's just a South Carolina problem, right? We always sort of think that, things are more peaceful in our home or these tensions aren't there. But about 7-8 years after the Denmark Vesey revolt, a man named David Walker, who had been born free in the South but had moved to Boston, wrote what was the most radical document that any Black man had released, at least publicly, in the United States of America. And it was called An Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World. And David Walker called on Black people, North and South, to rise up and seize their freedom. Now, he said the first step to freedom, though, is mental emancipation, that if Black people educated themselves and freed their minds, everything else would fall in place. But he began shipping this document into the South. This wasn't just circulated amongst free people in the North. And when authorities discovered this, the first place they discovered it was in Savannah, Georgia. And 3 days after they discovered Walker's appeal, they banned literacy in the Georgia State House. So they wasted no time. They shut down the ports to try to keep these documents from coming in. And then the third man, Nat Turner, he was not as connected, I guess, to larger communities as was David Walker or Denmark Vesey, but he is the actualization of their ideas, right? Nat Turner does start the largest slave revolt in the South. Nat Turner was also literate. And Nat Turner sets down and gives his confession over the course of 2 days to a white man who reprints it. And, you read that and you get a clear sense of like this young Black man who was literate at a very early age and actually was encouraged to be literate by the man who had enslaved him, that it was his literacy that made it possible for him to be a leader. And so through those three events, the South says, we can't have Black schools, we can't have Black literacy. And so that's where the war really starts on Black literacy.
All right, let me go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. If you want to join the conversation about the legacy of the oppression, the criminalization of Black literacy, let's go to Brad. And Brad, you're on the air. Go ahead, Brad.
Hey, I generally, from what I've read, there isn't that much demand by any people, any youngsters, for reading actual bound books on the library shelf. Could there be a movement that would maybe reach the readers by the phenomenon of the graphic novels, which are kind of like comic books? And I'm going to hang up and hear, talk to you and listen to your answer. Thank you.
All right, Brad, thank you for that. I produced a comic book called San Antonio's Secret History about some of San Antonio's, social justice moments. But what do you think, Derek?
I think you planted that question, David. No, I'm just kidding. First of all, I think the larger point, which the reader is spot on. I mean, I have enormous concerns about the difficulty of engaging young people in reading now. And I think that that's a problem. And I don't think it's a shortcoming of the literature or the comic books for that matter. I think it is a obvious phenomenon of our electronic age and a lot of distractions. But I think that our survival as a thoughtful people actually depends on our continued capacity to read long form books. And because one of the stories, or sort of one of the themes in Dangerous Learning, is that literacy itself is an act of becoming, right? That one discovers oneself through literacy in a corner, in the dark of the night, where one is free to agree or disagree, right? Where one is free to take one's mind somewhere else. I write in the book that there were Black people all over the South who were freed mentally without stepping one foot off the plantation. And that was meaningful to them. The extent to which, comic book does the same thing, or can do the same thing, I think I'll probably let people more knowledgeable on that distinction than myself know. But I do think we have to create time and space and create great books for young people to read. And I think that's where they become themselves. I've toyed with the idea and had other people second it, that actually Dangerous Learning deserves a young reader's version. I don't want to dumb it down, but I do want to take out maybe some more of the dry parts, because I think for young people to actually read about what their forefathers and foremothers went through and what books meant to them, I think is an important story to be told in its own right.
So, Denmark Vesey, talk about how the fate lottery entered into his story.
David, so there is this sort of wonderful democracy, freedom, liberty story, that I tell. But if you're just looking for pure drama, like for someone who just wants a good read with a lot of drama, these three men, Nat Turner, David Walker, and Denmark Vesey, more than any, really has it. I mean, Denmark Vesey is born into slavery in the Caribbean. He is then sold into slavery in Haiti, feigns epilepsy so that the person who bought him is forced to return him to the person that first sold him. He sails the high seas with Joseph Vesey for a few years, and then they settle in Charleston. And in Charleston, it actually wasn't the case that all enslaved people lived under the roof, so to speak, of the person who enslaved them. A lot of them actually lived in separate quarters, and they hired out their labor and shared the earnings. Well, Denmark Vesey did that. He was a skilled, literate man, and apparently he liked to use some of his earnings on lottery tickets. And as David suggests, he literally wins the lottery. For anybody who's been to Charleston and walked down Bay Street, Bay Street was built with the proceeds of lottery. And guess what? Denmark Vesey bought one of those tickets, except for, he paid $1 and he got $1,000 back, at least for that one ticket. And so he purchases his freedom with that ticket and walks free with several hundred dollars in his pocket. And that creates more space for him to read and write and engage with his community and become the sort of voice of freedom in amongst the Black community in 1820.
So you tell us that he attempted a revolt, a slave revolt, and it was found out and put down before it had a chance to catch on. But he went on trial. What about that trial? Was that an opportunity for Denmark Vesey to make a public appeal to what was happening?
Yeah, I mean, his trial is fascinating. We always have to, you know, be careful with his story because we only know of his story through the white people who prosecuted him. We don't have any written records from Denmark himself. But that trial was fascinating, and his literacy and the power of his literacy is on full display there. So first of all, imagine, you know, a black man in slavery's capital, right, Charleston, South Carolina, who the authorities say, we're going to give you an attorney, and that black man says, I don't need it, I'll defend myself, right? That he pushes his own attorney to the side in that period and says, I'll ask the questions, right? I'll do the cross-examination, which, you know, clearly was a sign of his learning. But not only that, he begins to assert legal rights that he could have only known of and only articulated because of his thorough reading of the United States Constitution, for instance. So really quite a remarkable man. They're breaking rules. He's calling them out. I mean, ultimately, I don't think it's his shortcomings that leads to his conviction, but just, you know, they sort of had already decided what they were going to do. So one, his literacy is on full display as he defends himself, but it also highlights to the authorities how dangerous that literacy is, right? That they begin to piece together, right, how he got to the point he was, and it was through his literacy.
Well, there was this record of that trial that was produced in order to, what, legitimize the trial? And then what happened?
Yeah, so the South, you know, we rarely see, not just the South, but all of us see the mote in our own eyes. But, you know, they say, you know, look, the South is going to accuse us of being unfair and just rushing to judgment with these black people. So what we will do is we'll print this record of the proceedings so they'll know that we treated him fairly. Now, I don't think they were going to convince the North of that, but the ironic thing is that a few weeks after publishing and circulating that trial record, they realized, oh my goodness, we just distributed a blueprint in black leadership to all the other literate black folks out there. So then they decided they had to collect them all and burn them. So this once openly distributed trial record becomes something that was kept under lock and key in the South. And in fact, the versions, the source version that I rely upon and many of us rely upon is from a copy that wasn't found until the North took control of Hilton Head in the middle of the Civil War. And so that copy of the trial transcript is now held at Harvard University.
But the fact that they would print this trial transcript or this record and then recognize that they had to burn them, and there were a few recovered that were under lock and key, kept someplace that were finally obtained during the war. I mean, that in itself is an indictment on this information war. You know, just take it to Alex Jones, forgive me, I'm using your term, info wars, but there was an info war going on.
Yeah, I mean, after these slave revolts, the info war, so to speak, really blossoms because they decided it wasn't enough just to criminalize black literacy. They needed to control what white people read as well. And so they began burning not just, you know, trial transcripts of slave trials. They began burning northern newspapers, you know, they called men of good standing is what they called them, broke into the Charleston post office in 1835 and looted it of all the newspapers and burned them in the town square. And after that, vigilance societies formed across the South to ensure that these northern newspapers wouldn't cross the Mason-Dixon line. So they completely closed down the South to at least any legal receipt of information or sort of outside versions of the story. So yeah, they're trying to sculpt a particular version of what's happening. And then, you know, a decade after that, once they've controlled what white people read, they decide, hey, we need a propaganda machine. And so they begin looking at all the textbooks in the South and trying to filter out northern bias. And my sort of prime example here was One of the three-page reviews in one of the major magazines is looking at this geography book and says that it must be ripped from the shelves in the South because it devotes disproportionate attention to northern crops. I mean,
right, but the main point from all that is how when the South complains so much about we have to have local control over our education system, we don't want a Department of Education, we want Southern textbooks, Southern scholars, Southern ideas, Southern culture in our education. This is what this is what they're after. But I got to go to break. We're going to continue our conversation. I've got Bonnie and Amy on the phones coming back from the break. If you want to join us, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book Dangerous Learning, The South's Long War on Black Literacy. We're joined by the author, Derek W. Black. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. We're going to go to Bonnie. Amy, you'll be next. But Bonnie, you're on the air. Bonnie, go ahead.
Hello. Okay, so my question is I learned a long time ago that the Anglo lower class weren't allowed to read unless the king, the priest, pastor, or bishop, whoever, assigned a lower caste person, predominantly male, to learn the Bible because they couldn't be there at all places of worship. And it was closely watched and documented who could read the Bible only. Do you think this is related to how the enslaved black people were kept illiterate? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, thanks for calling in, Bonnie. So is there a pattern whenever we have an oppressive regime? I've read that oligarchies, one of the things they want to do is defund public education. That's a factor of that. Is this part of a larger trend?
Well, let me get Bonnie's question because she actually hit an interesting piece. So I wasn't familiar with the story that she was telling, but I can tell you that in the South, one of the things that happened during this repression was that black people were not allowed to meet in groups larger than, let's say, three or four without a white person being present, after these slave revolts. And this included religious worship as well. And so a white person had to be present even for church services and the reading of the Bible. So that certainly tracks. And I also just want to come back because, you raised it earlier, David, just two sentences quickly about that information war. I mean, ultimately what the South was enforcing was an echo chamber that is not unlike the one we see today, right? It's just sort of one version of the story and everything else is excluded. And I say in the book that the South sealed the nation's fate for civil war, not when the first shots were fired at Fort Sumter in 1861, but in the 1830s when it determined there was only one official version of the story that could be told in the South.
Having a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin was grounds for being horsewhipped in the town square because they saw that book as being extremely dangerous to the South's social order.
Yeah, I mean, a number of materials were labeled seditious books, seditious materials, and it was illegal to even have them in your possession. It was just sort of like strict liability. If you are found with X items, you're subject to it. It depended on the state what the specific penalty was, it was quite repressive.
Let's go to Amy. And Amy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound great.
Okay. I love this conversation, and I look forward to purchasing and reading your book, Mr. Black. I just finished a semester of advanced research and composition at the university, and the entire semester I had my students reading American Slave Narratives. So I'm hoping a few of my students are listening right now. Who knows? I'd like to make a recommendation. Anyone who's interested in these stories of empowerment and literacy might enjoy Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. I teach it as sort of the counterpoint to Douglass's narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. It tells the female point of view. And with all of these slave narratives, of course, literacy is a major theme. Of course it is, because the power is in both what they're exposed to in their reading, but also their personal agency that they're able to express through reading and writing.
All right, Amy, thank you for calling in with that. And your reaction, Derek Black.
Yeah, I mean, she's spot on. There's a chapter in my book when I'm sort of talking about secret learning. That's, I'm talking about secret schools, but I'm also talking about the Black people who self-taught. And all of the sources for that chapter are the slave narratives. And Harriet Jacobs makes her way into that as well. You know, most people focus a lot on Frederick Douglass, and he really is a national and incredibly important figure. I try to tell a lot more stories from less known figures and sort of the grittier versions of day-to-day life. But Harriet Jacobs, one of the most interesting pieces of her literacy, and I really focus on it in the book, is that she is able to, number one, to stay ahead of her enslaver over the course of years solely as a result of her literacy. She's misleading him in her letters so that he can't find her. She's not revealing information. But even later, once she had escaped to the North, they used to print the names of new visitors in town, which that was a surprise to me, but they did. And so Harriet Jacobs read the newspaper every day for the names of new arrivals in town so that she would know, right, whether someone was on her trail. And so sure enough, on the day that that one of the people who enslaved her shows up to find her, she reads the name of the newspaper and she's gone. She's out of town, staying one step ahead.
So after the Civil War and we have Reconstruction, there's a blossoming of literacy in the formerly enslaved community. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, the most interesting thing to me was, and it has long been, was the passion that Black people showed for reading and writing during the Civil War, that as soon as they got their physical freedom, the very next thing they wanted was to learn to read and write. And this shows up not so much in their diaries, but actually in the journals of you know, military officials who were just surprised at this outpouring. And so the very first freedman school, so to speak, happens on the banks of Fort Monroe in Virginia, which is ironically enough also the place where enslaved Africans first landed in America. So sort of the first enslavement occurs in the same place where I say that Black people began to once again drink from the fountain of freedom with literacy. So first one there, but the Sea Islands in South Carolina is really where things blossom, because at the Battle of Port Royal, which was the first major battle that the North wins in the South, it takes control of a territory where all but about a dozen whites completely abandoned and 10,000 Black people are left there to their own devices. And what do they want? They want schools. And so Northern missionaries come to the Sea Islands in South Carolina, and this system of schools just rapidly grows and becomes a model for the rest of the nation. So these freedom schools spread as the Northern offensive spreads. They spread across the South, and those freedom schools become the breeding grounds for political leaders. They also become the foundation for the South's, you know, first real public education systems in the aftermath of the war.
I have a question from a listener. It says, who was actually enforcing the criminalization of literacy? Was it vigilante justice? Was it government officials? Who was doing the work of making sure African-Americans didn't learn to read and write?
Yeah, great question, because there's a variety. As I point out in the book, I mean, you've got the laws on the book, and then you've got the law, you know, of the slave master. And so whether it's legal or illegal, right, there were violent punishments that some enslavers, dismemberments and mutilations were common regardless of the law. So you have that. You have mobs who then descend on places. So I talk about in Charleston, for instance, when the Catholic Church had opened another school after the first repression, you know, a mob descends on them and just demands that they shut it down. And it's kind of, the police are kind of caught in the middle. You know, they're more worried about restoring order than anything. So the mob forces it to be shut down. But then you do have prosecutors. I tell a story of Margaret Douglass in Norfolk, Virginia, where someone learns that she's running a school for Black children, and the police show up and knock on her door and prosecute her. And, you know, I sort of detail that trial and her defense of herself. So the answer is all of the above. all of the above. I would be remiss, though, if I didn't say there were people who resisted that as well. Certainly had black people resisting it, but there were white people who said, I believe it is my duty as a Christian to share the Bible, to teach the Bible, and allow black people to access it itself. So there were white people who also defied those laws.
So was Bible literacy a large motivating factor for most of these communities that you're talking about?
It was a motivating factor for white people, right? There's two motivating factors. One is you had these religious societies that believed it was their Christian duty to teach the Bible, and so that was their motivation. You had other white slaveholders who saw that there was an economic advantage to teaching literacy, right? That literate enslaved people are more valuable. They can do more things. And so there was a self-interest amongst some slaveholders. And, of course, for black people, it was either physical freedom or mental freedom that they were after.
Well, you do have to wonder about the economic cost of keeping an entire population illiterate and enforcing that, the investments, the money, the public dollars you got to go to prevent people from learning to read and write, but also the economic cost because, as you detail in your writings, that this also impacted literacy in the white population.
Yeah, I mean, that's the part of the story that, easily gets glossed over because there was no public education system, so to speak, of in the South that the slaveocracy or the oligarchy had no interest in collecting taxes to educate poor and middle-income white children. So, their literacy wasn't criminalized, but it wasn't provided for either. And so I think the beauty of this story is that black people's fight for education in the aftermath of the war brings public education not just to them, but to the entire South. And as I often tell people, they say, hey, why is this white rural guy so interested and so passionate about this? Because I fully understand, right, that the reason why, the Constitution of the state of South Carolina, the Constitution of the state of Tennessee, the Constitution of North Carolina, on and on, the reason why they guarantee public education to my children and to me, to someone like me, is that because the freedmen forced those constitutional provisions into existence in the aftermath of the war. So this inheritance of public education that we share across the South, we owe a debt to the freedmen and their fight for this system.
We're taking another break. We'll continue our conversation with Derek Black, Dangerous Learning, The South's Long War on Black Literacy, 833-877-8255. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Derek Black is the author of Dangerous Learning, The South's Long War on Black Literacy. He is a constitutional scholar and an expert historian on education in the United States. So you mentioned how states had to adopt the clause and that were being readmitted into the Union, like Texas. Texas was forced to include the clause that public education would be available in our state constitution to be readmitted. Were states just not willing to do that?
Around public education, as I mentioned earlier, right? Because they understood this public education would serve black people. We have this sort of earlier period in which there is this suspicion and argument against it. So partly because of black people's calls, but also because, Congress said at one point that they thought the South might have never rebelled had it been more literate. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but it is true that white illiteracy was four times higher in the South than in the North. So in terms of both securing freedom for black people and reinforcing democracy itself, Congress insisted that Southern states guarantee public education in their constitutions. And the last three states that were readmitted to the Constitution, readmitted to the Union at the end of the Civil War were Texas, Virginia, and Mississippi. And so Texas is in this unique position that if, any of the readers looked up or, they could find it in my scholarship as well, that the statute that readmits Texas to the Union, right, as a state, requires that it never deprive any child of the education rights that it had just been forced to vest in its constitution. So not only did they have to provide for public education to reenter the union. They could never go backwards on it. Now, I'm sure a lot of your listeners say, I think we kind of went backwards. But nonetheless, if you look at that 1870 readmission for Texas, that's what it says.
Well, people have that argument. They're saying that there is a deliberate attempt to defund public education in the state of Texas, that this voucher thing is part of that. There is this attack on trying to characterize public education, public schools as failures. But, you know, people don't realize that is not a feature of public education, that it doesn't work. The feature is that it does work. When we do have issues with public schools, that's a glitch. That can be fixed.
Yeah, I mean, these conversations are always hard because, as I say, look, our public schools have never been perfect, and I hate to say it, I don't think they'll be perfect, be made perfect during my lifetime. But to your point, they have been on a trajectory of moving us closer to a more perfect union, that each time we have expanded the ballot, we have expanded public education and vice versa. So democracy has walked hand in hand with public education. And, unfortunately, we have large numbers of people that are, for the very first time in the history of America, believe that we may need to give up on the idea of public education. And I don't really understand the basis for it other than this emotional disunion or dissatisfaction with politics overall sentiment that's flooding. But if we look at the core of what our public schools represent, you're right. They are a future. They are a feature of expanding opportunity. They are a feature of reinforcing democracy.
So after Reconstruction and the Army of the North, the Union, retreats from the South, and we have Jim Crow being enforced, why then prevent African Americans and communities of color, Mexican Americans here in South Texas, why prevent them from having access to quality education? Is it because they don't want them to become a political force?
Yes. In my book, Schoolhouse Burning, I detail it maybe even more closely than I detail it in Dangerous Learning. In Dangerous Learning, I sort of track the curriculum a little bit more, this sort of lost cause narrative that tries to redefine what the Civil War was about and whitewash slavery, et cetera, et cetera. But to your point, David, the 1890 Constitutional Convention in Mississippi, which was the first major Jim Crow Constitutional Convention, on the day that it opens, the chair of the committee steps to the lectern and says, "We have come today for one purpose and one purpose only, and it is to disenfranchise the Negro." And what he meant by disenfranchise the Negro was to take away the ballot and to take away the schoolhouse. Right. That's what they spent weeks doing. That's what they wanted to accomplish. And, I haven't read recently Texas's Constitutional Convention, so maybe there's some variation there, but I can tell you South Carolina and other ones, same thing as Mississippi. But I will say something interesting happened at those, which is they moved with full force to take away the ballot from black people. But there was these discussions about whether they should remove public education from the state constitution altogether in Mississippi. And because of what I said earlier, which is that the freedmen brought public education to white people too. And so there were delegates at these conventions that said, look, you can segregate them, you can make them unequal, but we kind of like this public education thing. We shouldn't go backwards. We shouldn't take this away. And so in one of the, most virulent moments of racism in this country, public education survived, battered, but survived Jim Crow to fight another day in Brown versus Board of Education. And I think that's the question we confront right now. Should we remove these core pieces of our democracies, right, from our Constitution? Should we give up those commitments? And if we do, can public education survive this moment like it survived Jim Crow? That history remains to be written.
Last week, the Oklahoma Board of Education passed new curriculum standards that require educators to teach that the 2020 presidential election was rife with fraud or discrepancies. They want to teach in these classrooms that Donald Trump you know, should have won that election, not Joe Biden. Stop the Steal has become part of the education system, at least in one state. Of course, there's no evidence. There's nothing to back that up. But now it's just become something that they're going to teach. Is that alarming?
I didn't know about that, and you've almost left me speechless, although it sounds like another lost cause narrative, right? That
yes.
when the Redeemers in the South take back over after Reconstruction, they say, oh, this wasn't, you know, about slavery, and we treated Black people well, and they begin to rewrite history so that, you know, they're the victims rather than the perpetrators. And at least what I heard you saying is that Oklahoma is writing or wanting to teach a version of history in which President Trump was the victim in the election between he and President Biden.
Yeah, and so the idea, so other countries, they don't have this fractured education system that we have in the United States. Japan has, you know, one education system. And it's a highly successful education system. When you see that they want to sacrifice quality of education for a political agenda or to keep a major portion of the population uninformed or unable to be educated, the entire economy suffers.
Yeah, it does. Although, as you say that, I mean, I have my ambivalence about how fractured or unfractured education systems need to be, because let me, I know we're running short on time, so I'll try to be quick here. No single individual, no single entity has ever exercised unilateral control over what American children learn, you know, because it's fractured. And some days that upsets us because we have people who teach questionable things. But it there's also a good piece to that as well, right? Is that it protects us from the autocrat. 2 weeks ago, President Trump sent out what I call a loyalty oath, insisting that every single state superintendent and every single local superintendent in the United States of America sign a document in which they committed to not use DEI and to carry out what I call sort of his sort of racial ideology of equality in America. And, you know, number one, he has no legal authority to do that. But the more important point is that no single person has ever even attempted such a thing in the history of the United States. So there is something to be said for diverse control, in which we have to agree by consensus, not by unilateral fiat of any particular person.
So how does your book contribute to the broader discussion on race, education, and justice in the United States right now?
Well, I think it contributes to it in two ways. I mean, one, which I think is a timeless piece, which is what literacy means to us as humans. I say that this story, and particularly the individual stories, are the closest thing we have to a holy testament of the connection between humanity and literacy, what it does to a person, how it can free a person, what it means. I think that's a story we in our everyday lives need to keep. The other one is simply the story of how our racial history has persistently clouded our view of what good education policy is, of what right education policy is. And, it's still with us. Again, as we started this conversation, it is not the same today as it was in 1820. We're a much more diverse and disagreeable group of people today. But yet we still have pockets, substantial pockets of our politics that echo, you know, certain sentiments and just clouding our view of what it means to have a democracy that educates all of our citizens fairly.
And celebrate, you know, the positive vision of America.
Yeah, and then I should say, and the danger of censorship. As I said in the middle of this conversation, we the South seals the fate for war with censorship. I don't think we're heading for war right now, but it headed to war before, and I think that ought to tell us how dangerous citizen censorship is to a free and open democracy here and today.
Dangerous Learning, the South's Long War on Black Literacy. Derek W. Black, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.